episode number 244, no less, on Gatekeeper. And I'm speaking English because my guest today is American. His name is Professor John Yu, and he's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. Hello, John.
Gowdy, why did it take 245 episodes to get to me?
I just didn't
I'm
think
there would... I'm just imagining what my Israeli taxi cab driver would be saying.
It took 244 episodes to find a conservative in Berkeley, John.
That's very... Oh, well, then it should have hit around 10,000 before you got to me.
Yeah. So let me ask first, how is it that a conservative survives in UC Berkeley?
I have to say, one thing is I'm a product of, I've been thinking about it lately because I just finished my 30th year teaching, and I was hired by, now that I think about it, these Jewish guys who are from the Midwest of our country, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and they came to California in the 50s. And in the California, the 50s was the promised land. It was where everybody wanted to go. And these guys, they were old New Deal liberals, people, they, you know, no one would know them anymore. People like Sandy Kadish, Jesse Choper. They're actually very interested in Israel. Some of them wrote and participated in fora in Israel. And they still believed in the idea that you got the truth by having people of many viewpoints around. So they wanted to have at least one conservative around. Two would be unfair, but one was okay. So, you know, in their infinite wisdom, they thought they should hire someone who was more from the Scalia, Bork, conservative legal movement, even though they didn't agree with it at all. And I have to tell you, they loved arguing with me. Oh, they really did. They enjoyed it so much. Or they would say, John, they would come by my office and say, John, I don't understand. Why do conservatives want to lower taxes? What's that all about? And I would on behalf of half the country explain why half the country wanted lower taxes. So what worries me, I guess we'll talk about this, is I think their approach to running the universities is disappearing in the United States. And now we see this kind of progressive wokeism, which doesn't believe, it seems to me, in full diversity of viewpoint. They feel about diversity of ethnicity, yeah, but they would like to have a monotone of viewpoint.
Yeah, that's the whole thing with identity politics. It's the least tolerant position one can take. And you know, I can't say his name, but I have a friend in a Midwestern university who teaches classic English lit. That was his passion from his college days, and they don't let him teach anymore. He just doesn't teach. You know, he's tenured, and they've just ruled out all his courses because they're on the classics, because they're on the canon. You can't teach William Faulkner, you can't teach Hemingway, you can't teach any classic American anymore. And it seemed that this polarization, first of all, Israeli academia is very much influenced, like the rest of the world, by American academia, because, as you know, if you don't publish in leading journals, which are mostly American, and if you don't have recommendation letters from American institutions, then you can't advance. And this was when I came to my university, Hebrew University, I asked one of the older professors, I said, how does this bias develop institutionally that so many people here are so fiercely anti-Zionist in the flagship of Israeli higher education? And he said, they're not. It's just that they have to publish. And what they have to publish is in journals controlled by this Edward Said frame of mind. Mm-hmm. And then they become that after a while. And you can see that again now that there's the boycott of Israel, the academic boycott, and
I find that abhorrent, by the way.
Unbelievable. Yes. But academics here are incentivized to spew hatred of their own public in order to advance themselves outside of Israel.
I have this argument all the time with my Israeli friends in the legal academy, and I say, why do you respect the UN? Why do you respect the International Court of Justice? Why do you care what the International Criminal Court says when, you know, as an outsider, it seems so obvious these international institutions are aimed at harming Israel, that there's this heavily anti-Semitic atmosphere in them? And they say to me, It's exactly as you say. They say Israel is a small country. There aren't that many of us, there aren't that many institutions. We need to be accepted by the global community. And
Yeah.
so, in order to be accepted, we have to be even more scrupulous. And, so, right, Israel's being sued by South Africa and the ICJ. It's incredible. The only people who have suffered real genocide in the modern time, world, the 20th century, are being sued for committing genocide. It's just almost ridiculous. By South Africa, of all countries, is so ridiculous. We were sued by Nicaragua in the 1980s about supporting the Contras. We just withdrew. We just said, we're out of the ICJ. We're not going to participate anymore. But my, Israeli legal friends, this is they can't conceive of such an idea because they want to be accepted by this sort of global elite world order slash international organizations structure. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
One last point is at the same time, even though the internally you can see the rot now that's within the Western universities, not just American, I think the West. At the same time, and I don't really understand how this is, they're still far better than any university you would see in Europe, in China, in Russia, Latin America. And that puzzles me. Maybe it's, a great advantage built up by our forefathers who invested so much in education and research, and now we're just wasting away our heritage. But it's a paradox to me that our universities are so great. Western civilization is at the height of its, right? I think its achievement, but it's eating away itself internally.
Yeah, that's terrible. And Israel is at the heart of this fight because, my favorite political thinker of the time is John Fonte, because I think that nobody else understood better that the current ideological war in the West as a whole, and in Israel too, and in America certainly, is between globalism, patriotism, he called it, and democratic sovereignty versus transnational globalism. And when you think of it, Israel is at the heart of it. And John Fonte also points to this, that the ideologues of transnationalism have in their mind imprinted in the Western tradition the idea of Pax Romana, the idea that the Roman Empire would bring universal peace. And at the other pole is Jerusalem. So it's really Rome and Jerusalem, because Jerusalem stood for particularism and kept rebelling against empires, sometimes crazily. I'm not proud of any of a bunch of Jews hiding in a cave and declaring war on the Roman Empire. That's suicidal, but at least it preserved the flame of the ability to defend a national identity. And this is under very serious attack all over the West. And I think Israel, if Israeli scholars had a little more confidence and a little less subservience and starstruck admiration for anything American, they would understand that we, especially Israeli conservatives, have a serious role to play in Western
Oh,
culture,
yes.
and we're not living up to that
Yeah, maybe
role
can
for
I
now.
actually I wrote the legal counterpart to John's book on sovereignty called
Really?
Taming Globalization. Yeah, it was really pitched to a legal audience, but it was on the one hand, you have this technocracy that says we have all the answers. All the pro Oh, and by the way, all the problems are global. They're not really regional or local, national. Every
They're all
problem is
global
global.
warming
They're
style.
all global. Yeah, exactly. Every problem is global. Therefore, the answer must be provided by this, highly educated technocratic elite. It's really the ultimate in progressivism. And we tried to say, but that is irreconcilable with democracy by consent, right? That you
Exactly.
can't, how do you can't transfer all that power. So we tried to show ways that the nation state could restore its control over. Sometimes we'll do what the global elites think is the best answer, but only after it's been democratically accepted. And then it was a plea for sovereignty and nation state exceptionalism. So I agree that I think I spent a summer at the IDC teaching, and I loved Israel. But as you say, Israel is at the forefront of the clash of these ideas. And to me, Israel's like a crucible. It's where the ideas are sharpest. They come into con It's not just because Israelis like to argue. It's because I have to tell you, the teaching experience was wonderful, by the way. I've never had a class where I would say something, and then the students would interrupt me, and then they would start arguing with each other, and I was almost like a spectator. It was the best. But Israel's like a it's a crucible of nations, of the virtues, I think, of the nation state. Where else could you had an Israel nation state against these weird Arab socialist and then Islamist country driven by these pan-Arab ideologies? And to me, Israel always shows why the nation state is the most effective unit, why the most effective way for people to organize themselves. You have this tiny country that has, to me now, is the most powerful country in the Middle East, not because it wants to conquer, just because it wants to be safe and secure and live on its own.
I wish we would stay this way and get our bearings, because with this almost pro-Iranian administration, Iran is fast becoming a dominant force here, and we have all been sleeping on our noses in terms of the military. And I can get on into this because we do it all day, but I would love for us to, first of all, to ask you from a Berkeley point of view, before we get into Trump, which was the reason we convened here, is do you feel, is anti-Semitism a physical danger to Jews on your campus nowadays?
So I think that you do have people on campus, students, some students, I think a lot of people, and I think this is true of all these campuses, people who have come there from outside the town or who might live there but aren't part of the university. And I do think those people, you've seen video, do pose a physical threat to Jewish students. I would say this, though. I think 95 to 99% of the students, faculty, and staff, they're no threat at all. They don't believe in this. But there's 1 or 2% who have proven themselves dangerous. And so universities, I'm afraid, have to take a stronger hand in protecting Jewish students. I can't believe I have to say that in the United States of
Yeah.
2024, that authorities have to protect Jewish students, that we would have learned the lessons, but we did not. And I find contemptible how slow some of our university leaders have been, in properly protecting them. I'm afraid, it takes political pressure, I'm afraid. What you saw in Congress with the deans, presidents of Harvard and Penn had to resign, what you've seen with political pressure, lawsuits even. But I'm afraid I do think it's true. I do think that I've had Jewish students tell me stories that you don't see appearing in the press because they don't want to, in a way, inflame things or make matters worse, but they want to figure out a way to force the universities to protect them, just the way they would protect any student group. The Jewish students aren't asking for anything special. I mean, what I say to my friends is, what do you think would happen if a similar number of people showed up on the Berkeley campus or the Columbia campus, as KKK members calling for white supremacy, right? The universities would have clamped down on those people in a nanosecond. And so I would just want the universities to administrators to show the same, just equal protection for Jewish students that they would for any other student.
But the whole structure of identity politics has labeled Jews as white, and so as oppressors. And so this system of thought, it does not have a goal for just and unjust, just for powerful and powerless. And if you have the misfortune to be both powerless and labeled as powerful, then nothing in this system can help you. But the things have they've gone in America into politics, and the rise of Trump is at least there was at least in part a reaction to this form of identity politics. It was interesting that the explanation of the Democratic Party for the rise of Trump was that it was just angry white men, and it was all racism, but it actually was a rise against identity politics. And now the state apparatus has been mob and the legal system has been mobilized in the criminal aspect. Not just, I'm not talking about Russian collusion now, but Trump has just been convicted in a New York court on 34 counts, was it? What exactly is he guilty of in according to the verdict?
Apparently, he's guilty of being a bad character. I hate to say it, but Laurentiy Beria, who was Stalin's Secret Service chief, said, "Show me the man, and I'll show you the crime." And it's right; it's undeniable that's what's happening here, and it actually revealed itself during the trial. The prosecutors said, formally, the prosecutor said, Donald Trump didn't account for certain payments in the right way in his bookkeeping, and that's usually what we call misdemeanor. It's like a ticket. You just pay a fine and it's over with. But in order to claim it's a felony, which means jail time, serious jail time, and a jury trial, and the whole, the scene you saw on television, they had to say the misdemeanor was a cover-up for something greater, some greater crime. The prosecution never said what that greater crime was. They would say things like, "Oh, this was done to change the outcome of the election." That's not a crime, right? Actually, in fact, right? Think about all the stories people make up or don't make up or try to suppress and get out there in a campaign. If that's a crime, then those 51 intelligence officers who said Hunter Biden's laptop was Russian disinformation, they all committed a crime too, right? So they had a real problem. So at trial, if you watched it day to day as I was, what the prosecution really did was, since they couldn't really explain the crime, they just dragged Trump through the mud. And this is unfortunately something I find bad prosecutors will do, is they will say, "We'll just show you what a bad person this guy is. You've got to convict him of something, you, the jury." Right? And that's what they did. They made Trump, and Trump's not a great character. You wouldn't want him to marry into your family, right? You wouldn't want him to be your brother-in-law or son-in-law. But that's not illegal to be a bad person, right? What was the actual crime? So that was the so you put your finger at Gotti. What actually did he do that violated the law? The second thing I would say is, if the real greater crime was changing the outcome of the election, which only on the last day of the trial, actually, the prosecutors said he might have violated federal election law. It's as if Trump made an illegal campaign contribution to himself with these payoffs. I mean, the logic of it just makes no sense. The larger problem is,
And the payoff is
Israel's
the
not like
payoff to Stormy Daniels. I
to Stormy
forget
Daniels.
her real name. That, just for our listeners who don't remember the details, this is a porn star that Trump once apparently had an affair with, and he paid her in order to keep quiet about it.
Yeah, hundreds. And you had this lawyer, Michael Cohen, who paid her $170,000. He claimed that Trump reimbursed him for the $170,000, and that was the illegal campaign contribution to himself, which can't really be illegal because rich, people are allowed to self-fund their campaigns. It actually doesn't make sense. So what happened then was, I mean, if that really was the larger crime, Israel, most other countries don't copy the American system of federalism, where we actually have these autonomous states and we have the federal government and there's a division of responsibility. In our system, only the federal government is allowed to prosecute. Only Washington, D.C. can prosecute violations of federal election law. And so the deeper problem is that you have this DA who's elected, right, just in this little city. It's a big city, but it's just a city, prosecuting a federal candidate for president because he violated federal election law, which the federal government investigated and decided not to prosecute. So two negative consequences flow from this, I think. I made this argument in National Review, actually right before the verdict came out. So one is, and I'm very curious to hear the Israeli perspective, obviously, because you have these investigations going into the prime minister. But one is, this, I think, is going to make presidents risk averse. As I said in the piece, we're going to have a presidency filled with insurance claims adjusters, because they're always going to be worried now about their what we call litigation risk. What if I have to do this to protect the country? Am I going to get prosecuted next year or 2 years or 10 years down the line? They're going to have to think about that now. And then the second problem. So I mean, that's incredible to think that your executive branch here or is other countries, you have to worry now about the person who's president, their personal vulnerability to being prosecuted someday in the future based on decisions they have to make right now for the best interests of the country.
And you
And
pointed
then
out
this.
in your piece at National Review that Americans so far in more than two centuries of politics have refrained from prosecuting presidents and of course the clemency to Richard Nixon by Gerald
Yes.
Ford is perhaps the closest it came to prosecuting a president. And you said in your piece that this is wise because of the reasons you now point to that you don't want your chief executive thinking about r what will happen to him after he's president when he makes
Yeah,
executive decisions.
the decisions are hard enough. You know, if
Yeah.
President Obama, for example, is deciding to use a drone to strike, right, a car. And this is a real case, a car with terrorist leaders in the car, and there's an American in the car. Does he should he be worried about being prosecuted for murder someday because some prosecutor in some city, some town in the 2,500 counties where we have elected DAs thinks, oh, I don't agree with Obama. I don't think that was the right thing to do. So yeah, just descriptively, you know, put aside a normative aspect, just descriptively, we have not gone after past presidents, even though I'm not claiming that presidents haven't violated the law before, but if you just look at recent history, Bill Clinton committed perjury, right, during the whole independent counsel investigation. In fact, his lawyer said, oh, if he committed perjury, just prosecute him afterwards, after he's president, but don't impeach him. But George W. Bush, you know, the administration I served in, decided we're just going to let Bill Clinton go. We're not going to prosecute him for perjury, right? People wanted to prosecute George Bush for invading Iraq or the war on terrorism. Obama let drop. People wanted to tell, you know, prosecute Obama for drone strikes. They let that drop. Even Donald Trump, you know, this is the thing. People think Donald Trump's a terrible guy. But Donald Trump, who campaigned on the campaign platform of lock Hillary up, right? Hillary could easily have been prosecuted for all these things Donald Trump's being investigated for in Florida about mishandling classified information. She took thousands of classified emails and rooted them into her home computer,
Yeah,
which easily could have been hacked.
and that was not just negligence as they
It
portrayed.
was
It was
intentional, yeah.
not just it, they stripped some document off the classifying signs on them. And there's serious doubt about the motivation because, as we know, Hillary Clinton was a senator and then a secretary of state, while foreign leaders and big shots all around the world were contributing to the Clinton Foundation. So
Oh
there
yeah,
might
and
have been
so
some motive there.
yes. And look, the people wanted to investigate her. I remember at the time, people at the Justice Department said, "Why are we not investigating the Clinton Foundation? Why are we not going after Hillary Clinton for this, you know, as you said, intentional, deliberate taking of classified thousands of classified documents out of the government for her own personal use?" Nobody, again, people thought it was best. And this is the other thing. People think it's best that presidencies, administrations after elections not be about relitigating the past because it's tough enough, right, to come up with the policies to make sure our future is better. So I think presidents of both parties and our system, thousands of prosecutors over the decades thought the best thing to do was let it go. I'm not saying legally you couldn't do it, but as this is a matter of statesmanship and prudence, not legal authority. One last point about this. You could say maybe that judgment leadership is gone. I would say a good president, like if Biden was a better president, he would have told the DA in New York to stop. And
Yeah.
he would have said, let's wait to see what the let the people vote in the election. You know, you're interfering with the operation of the presidency here. You're doing just great damage to the pre. So this is the thing. I don't know if this is true in Israel, but when you have this vacuum, I think, of good statesmanship and leadership, it's not legal. It's just sort of a, you know, it's hard to put your fingers on why someone's a great leader. But in the vacuum, the legal system fills it in. And
Yeah.
the vacuum, when the legal system fills it in, the problem with the legal system, it goes to extremes. You either have guilty, not guilty. You know, one side wins, one side loses. You can't compromise. You can't come up with sensible solutions. It's so binary, and it pushes you to extremes even more.
Will it have a backlash? Will it backfire? Because a lot of people are looking at this and saying, this is a show trial, and this is an attempt by a Democratic DA in a Democratic district where the jury is also biased to block the leading competitor for the presidency his camp from election.
Unfortunately, and I discussed this in the piece. Unfortunately, I think the only way it will stop is if some Democrats get prosecuted too, because if you think about it as a matter of strategy or escalation, or this is actually the theories about litigation we study in the United States actually derive from the work of people who study conflict. It's very similar, in nuclear conflict strategy in particular. And so, if one side keeps escalating, and this is a major escalation, as you point out, first time in 200 years, cross this Rubicon of prosecuting presidents. If the other side doesn't do anything, then the Democrats are just going to keep doing it over and over again. And to me, it seems like the only way that it will stop is if, unfortunately, some DA prosecutes Joe Biden or some DA prosecutes Hillary Clinton. And both sides realize we can't destroy this system just in pursuit of our narrow advantage. The system actually worked better. There was an equilibrium when we both showed self-restraint. Unfortunately, that is deterrence. Unfortunately, you have to return some measured, and sometimes the other side has to do it worse. So one example, it's a minor example, but it really shows, because none of this is governed by the law or courts, actually, is when you choose to use these great powers of prosecution, is once upon a time, we used to have filibusters in the Senate, they're called, the ability of a minority to stop a vote on judges, confirming judges. And the Democrats under Obama really wanted to fill the lower courts. So they said, we're getting rid of the filibuster. We're going to allow just majority rules when it comes to confirming lower court judges. And so, Republicans said, that's a break. That's a tr break in 200 years of tradition. You shouldn't do that. Democrats did it anyway because they really wanted to win. So when Trump got into office, Republicans said, okay, well, now we're getting rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court justices too. We're escalating a little more. And now we're going to get three justices on the Supreme Court in 4 years and change the entire direction of American jurisprudence. And I think that produced, right, a necessary equilibrium, but that's what you have to do. I think I'm afraid when both sides are, doing things that are new and unprecedented, the only way to put a stop to it, I think, is for some Republican DAs to prosecute Hunter Biden, prosecute Joe Biden, prosecute Hillary Clinton. Then I think both sides will stop.
Couldn't it be that the opposite will occur, that escalation will just go out of control? You know, Dr. Strangelove,
Yes.
doomsday machine?
Yes, I mean, I think that's also possible. I mean, it's always, this is, in fact, the people who study this say the possibility of that is actually what draws people back to their senses. The possibility that you just might unleash a complete, right, run to Armageddon is what actually causes people to step back. That's why mutually assured destruction worked between the US and the Soviet Union. Right, you might remember the 73 war. In Israel, the United States actually increased its nuclear alert to get the Russians to stop pouring in weapons to Egypt. And it worked because the Russians saw, oh my God, Nixon's a crazy man. Kissinger's crazy. They might actually, let the whole thing, unleash the whole escalation
Actually,
thing. I
Kissinger
think that.
did it on his own accord without waking up Nixon that
Oh, I
night.
didn't know
Yeah,
that. Really?
according to his memoirs.
But
I
he
don't
should
have
have
it.
done that, but that sounds like Kissinger.
It does. It does.
Sometimes I think Kissinger didn't understand the chain of command in the federal government between president and secretary of state, national security advisor.
And
But
not
that,
for the
I
first
mean,
time, not for the first time
not, or the
in his
last
career.
time. But I think you're right. That's always something you want to worry about, is that do you get into a spiral where our politics goes completely right off the rails and there's no restraint from either side? That's happened from time to time in American politics, but and that this goes, I think, to some things we were talking about earlier. sometimes the norms of the community and the nations of the nation bring us back to our senses. The politicians understand you can't have a, winner takes all, any means necessary wins. Although they are teaching that in our universities these days.
What do you think of Trump's chances? We in the Middle East are really worried because we feel, at least those of us who are on my side of the divide, which in Israel is the clear majority, is very much afraid of another Biden presidency, because the policy so far in the Middle East has been the appeasement of Iran, and that lit the area on fire. That just strengthened all its proxies and its own boldness. And it's going to go nuclear. So these elections are really crucial for us. After this scary introduction, what's your estimation?
I mean that, and Israel's not unique in that regard. I mean, if you're Taiwan, Korea, Japan, Europe, just a short point is what you're seeing is not necessarily Biden wants it that way. I think Biden, we talked about the Kissinger and Nixon episode. Kissinger and Nixon really believed presidents had to exert leadership on top of the bureaucracy, because if the bureaucracy left to its own devices, this is the policy you see in the Middle East now. This is the I think we're seeing this is the State Department bureaucracy at work. This is what they've always wanted, is this kind of policy. And presidents have to control and push their own, right, agenda and policies on top of that, and not let the bureaucracy run things. So that's the thing. I think you're quite right. If Biden were to win, you'll just see more of this, right? State Department wants to come to an accommodation with all of our rivals and opponents in the world. I think right now, if the election were today, Trump would win. I think most political analysts would agree with that. If you had my friend Karl Rove on the show, he would say that. If the election were today, Trump might even win an outright majority of the national vote, not just the Electoral College putting the states together. I mean, the polling shows Trump ahead of Biden, not just in the battleground states, we call them, but nationally, because Biden, again.
Is the margin, though, larger than their ability to cheat? Let's say even legally cheat, or all this ballot harvesting and all the things we saw. Because some cynical observer, when I asked that, some smart observer of the American scene who's also cynical said, he can win if his margin will be larger than their ability to cheat.
Yeah, I don't think they cheat in terms of breaking the law. I think the Democrats cheat legally, right? Like, as you say, ballot harvesting, early voting. The Republicans 4 years ago made a terrible mistake, by saying just vote on election day. Don't use all these additional rules, which Democrats have gone state by state to change. So, I think right now, I don't think it would be that close. Would it be so close? And if you look at the battleground states, Trump is not only ahead in all seven of them, and we're talking about states like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, but some of them are not even 10 point within 10 points anymore. Some of them are not even battleground states. So to be ahead in every single one by the margins, Trump is ahead in most polls. I mean, there's going to be variation. At this close to the election, Trump will win today. The problem is Trump is a chaos agent. He loves the chaos, right? So, if he played it safe, I think he would probably win, but he can't help himself. He's got to introduce who knows what he's going to do in the next, right? In the next 5 months. That's the problem. It makes it unpredictable. But usually our elections, when you have an incumbent running, and it was true 4 years ago, is a referendum on the incumbent. And Joe Biden has done a terrible job. I mean, he is extremely unpopular. I think he's more unpopular now than Trump was 4 years ago. I mean, he's during COVID. I mean, he is really unpopular. His policies abroad and at home have been a real mess. No one thinks they're better off now than they were 4 years ago. That's actually ironically why the Biden reelection campaign is all about Trump too. They want Trump to be convicted, because that's the only thing they're really running on right now, is Trump is a convicted felon now. You can't let that guy become president. Don't look over there about our Iran policy, China policy, or inflation. that's
Or immigration.
why they need the win so bad. Yeah, immigration. That's why they need the win in court so badly. But I don't think it's going to make a big difference. I don't. I have this feeling that it will. It could make a difference among a small number of independents. But I got to think when Americans show up to the polls in November, yeah, everybody already has this view that Trump's a bad character. They might let a vote for him again anyway because the times are so bad. You don't want a nice guy in the office, right? Because
Yeah.
to do the terrible things that have to be done. Biden might be a nice guy. I don't think he is, but he might be a wonderful guy. But you don't need a nice guy in the presidency. It might actually be counter-effective.
He's also there are also corruption scandals around the Biden family that are clearly more worrying than anything Russian collusion could have ever been. These people have taken money from companies like CEFC, who are fronts for the Chinese Communist Party. These are very serious allegations, and yet the system is so one-sided that the press is not talking about it. The legal system didn't do anything about it. Now we have to wait and see with Hunter Biden. But if Biden is such a liability, he's also clearly not in the best cognitive shape. Is there still a chance for a last minute, would you say, bait and switch, or just switch?
Your command of American idiom is outstanding. I love that. Not bait and switch, just switch. So I think there's actually, and I don't think this was intentional, but I think this is actually a hidden benefit of the debate schedule. Because as you know, we have a the first one having two presidential debates, and one is strangely in June. Never have presidential debate this. We haven't even actually formally picked the nominees in either convention. So you have one in June and then one in, near the election, and I think it's in middle September. That makes no sense. I think what Biden wanted to do was they're really worried about the president in the first debate doing a bad job. Incumbent presidents often do a bad job in their first debates. So they wanted it in June, so it's so early that people won't remember it by September. But the hidden benefit of that is suppose Biden does a terrible job. You have enough time to switch the candidate. If Biden does such a bad job in June, the Democrats still have time to swap somebody else in. It seems to me it's got to be Kamala Harris because, but this depends on how much you think the progressives are wedded to identity politics, or how much they want power. Because if it's identity politics, then I don't see how the Democrats could turn down Kamala Harris, first black woman vice president,
Wow.
be the first black woman candidate for president. She would be, in their mind, the first woman president. First, I mean, that would be such a how could they turn her down? On the other hand, you want to talk about the gap between Trump and Biden right now? It's like between here and here with Harris. I mean, Harris is extremely unpopular. She's done it, even Democrats think she's done a poor job as vice president. And I think Trump would wallop her throughout the country. So if you're a Democrat and you're seeing this, this train coming down the tracks at you, what you would want to do is swap Biden out and put in one of the popular, more moderate centrist governors, like my home state, like Josh Shapiro from Pennsylvania, I think has done a great job as a moderate Democrat. Or there's another Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan. There's a fellow Jared Polis in Colorado, who would be the first gay president. I mean, you've got a lot of potential Democratic, really solid candidates, but they and they would probably win. Compare if Trump, think this way, if Trump and Biden are this close, and as you say, Biden's policies are terrible, Biden's cognitively, you can tell he's cognitively not all there. You replace him with a 45-year-old successful governor, they'll beat Trump. This shows the hold already of the identity politics on the Democratic parties. They can't make that move.
You're convinced they can't?
I wonder. I wonder. The history of the Democratic Party has been that they have made the necessary changes because they want to win elections. I always found it, Democrats think this of themselves. I don't think it's true. It's usually Republicans who like to die on their sword for some principle. But I've always found, Democrats made a lot of changes in order to win elections in the past. I would think they would today, but they are so intellectually wedded to identity politics now. I don't think they could deny the nomination to Kamala Harris if Joe Biden shows himself in June, later this month, to not be capable of, running an elect, running for candidate and operating the presidency. But I've been wrong before about my Democratic friends. And I'm sure I will be again. But being in Berkeley, this goes to your first question. But being in Berkeley, I one, one advantage of it is I'm surrounded by communists and Marxists and progressives, and I get to hear all the things they think and, things they just think are common assumptions. And they think Kamala Harris is wonderful.
Oh, they
It's
do.
just, oh, they do. Oh, they love her. They think she's fabulous. They really do. It's so. It's even though you can tell the majority of the American people really dislike her.
Well, my feeling always is that Obama calls the shots in the Democratic Party, and he is a cold-blooded pragmatist. So, I mean, he's an ideologue, but he's a like a communist before him. He's ideologically inflexible, but tactically very flexible. But he's
I
also
wish there
wedded.
were more conservatives like him.
But they're yeah, he's also wedded to identity politics, personally. John, it was a unique pleasure speaking to you. I don't think my listeners have gotten such a detailed analysis of the American scene, certainly not of the legal aspect of it. So you're still in Europe and on your way back home. I hope we can one day catch you there closer to the election and feel the temperature again. Thank you so much for making the
Gotti,
time.
I would really love to come back. I really enjoyed talking with you. I love Israel. Let me also say to your listeners, I hope they don't think what they see on American campuses represents how the American people feel about Israel. That's a tiny, tiny minority of Americans. And you see the polls, two, three quarters of Americans want support Israel in getting the job done in the West, I'm sorry, in Gaza. And I spent the summer in Israel. I came back with, newfound respect for Israel, as we discussed. And I think many Americans feel that way. So I hope they realize America, Americans love Israel, love our friends. It's the leadership of that country, I think, that's making the mistakes right now.
Yeah, I think we can understand it because we have the same problems with our own elites, which we often feel don't like us either. It's exactly the same phenomenon with elites in America. Thank you so much, John, for making the time to speak with us.
Thank you.